is the public hearing and possible work session on the wing renovation. We're just going to go into a public hearing only. Well, this is on the agenda first.
I know. He told me this was first.
All right.
What are we doing first, Dave?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I would suggest that we go straight to the web publishing policy.
Go straight to the web publishing policy. We're going to open the hearing on the web publishing policy. Mr. President, we're happy to accommodate you. Hearing's open.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Henderson, the legislative administrator. You have in your packet a number of documents. This is the item on top, and it is titled Legislative Website Publishing Policy. I'm going to give you a brief background on how we got to where we are, and then I'm going to ask Rich Anglis, our IS manager, to give you an overview of the policy that we are asking the committee to approve today. We initially developed a website publishing policy a number of years ago, probably five or six years ago, but for a variety of reasons it was never formally adopted by the committee. We have had some issues that have come up in about the last 6 months that have led us to believe that this would be a good time to formalize the policy and actually, frankly, make it a little bit more strict than what we've been doing. In the past, we have allowed a number of links that we felt were of value to legislators and their constituents, such as links to local sites of interest in their districts or local chambers of commerce or things of that nature. And over the course of time, we've had some requests for some links that appeared to us to be inappropriate. So early this year, we requested an opinion from legislative counsel on the nature of these links, and a copy of that opinion is included in your packet. Based on that opinion, a number of the links that we had allowed had the potential to be in violation of either ethics statute or election statute. Once we got this opinion, we reviewed what links were available on the legislative website, and we did find somewhere on the order of about 1,000 links that had the potential of being in violation of the statute. We're not saying they were in any way, but there was that potential there. We also found fewer than 10 that definitely were in violation of the statute. They were links to campaign sites or political party sites. We're certain that there was no effort on the part of the members to put those up there inappropriately. They probably got listed in a newsletter and got on the website totally by accident. As soon as we identified those sites, we contacted the members on whose personal pages those sites existed, and they were very pleased to have us remove those. So I believe there were, as I recall, 8 links that were pretty clearly in violation of the statute. But we contacted those members. They were very thankful. There was no question, and they did want us to remove those. At the same time, we then terminated the links to the other sites in the interest of basically being probably overly cautious, because we wanted to make sure that we were in compliance with the Legislative Council opinion. Since then, we brought back the policy that we had developed a number of years ago, updated it to reflect the information included in the Legislative Council opinion, and we've worked through this with the staff directors and the chiefs of staff in all of the leadership offices, and that's how we got it into the form that it's before you today. I'm going to ask Rich to speak very briefly about the policy, and then I'm going to tell you about one amendment that we would suggest before we even ask you to vote on the policy, and then as soon as we get 3 senators and to go with the representatives, we'll be in a position to ask you to proceed on a vote.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rich Anglis. I'm the Information Systems Manager for the Legislature, and I'd like to just walk you through a few of the key points in the policy and kind of point out a few things that we think are very important. I should point out, first of all, that this has the format and a lot of the same wording as our other two IT policies. We have an IT use policy and an acquisition policy, so this is based on that same format, and a lot of the definitions are identical, so we're carrying forward some of the stuff we had before. on the first page under definitions, we have a very broad definition here of agency head, and we wanted to make it clear in this policy head, or this policy, that agency head means legislators as well as staff directors and managers throughout the building. So we're very clear here about who is an agency head and has authority under this policy. On the second page, we have a definition of legislative website. It's item G, and you'll see that it's a very broad definition. This we are defining legislative website as the entire collection of documents that are out on the web related to the legislature. And we feel like all of those pages and all of the sites are a reflection of website publishing for the legislature, so they should all be included. A new term that many of you may not be familiar with is item L. We have put in a definition of web editor. It's a position in Dave's office and Legislative Administrator's office, and the primary purpose of that position is to assist members and others with putting content out on the legislative website. So it's important for the policy that you know about that particular position as well. As we look at the policy on page 3 then, the policy itself, we have a mechanic at the top. Information Systems has been charged in our other policies with drafting policies related to information technology, so we have that same authority here just to draft and present them to you for approval. The second bullet, item B, is lawful use, and just the first sentence there is the primary thing we wanted to get across here. The legislative website may only be used for public purposes. That's the primary purpose here. It is a public vehicle for getting information out to the public, and so it's to be used for public purposes. Item C talks about web architecture and design, and Information Systems has been charged with creating the architecture, which is the look and feel and all the underlying structure, technical structure for the websites. And it also indicates that legislator websites will be consistent. So that's one key point in the policy, is we want to have a consistent look so that each legislator will have similar information out on the website. Item D talks about publishing content, and the policy indicates here that publishing on the website is just an extension of all the other publishing that the legislature does. So this is no different than publishing things via the print medium, and so we want people to think in terms of that same kind of thought process, if you will. So anything that goes out on the website needs to have the same approvals, the same reviews, if you will, of that a print document does. It's very important. It goes out to the public just like the printed medium does. So we state that here, and we also indicate that whatever we publish here is subject to the rules and standards that already exist throughout the building for publishing in other places. On the next page, on page 4, at the very top, still under item D, we indicate that all content that's published on the legislative website then must be approved by the appropriate legislator or agency head. And we have also given the agency heads the authority and responsibility for conducting periodic reviews of the information that they put out on the site to make sure that it remains current. We also, at the bottom of that one, of item D there, have given the authority to move content and files out to the legislative website to the web editor, the position in Dave's office we talked about. Under security, this internet is one of the areas where we need to have very, very tight security. I'm sure you all know of the problems we have with the internet and people trying to hack sites and do things we don't want them to do. So Information Systems has been charged with maintaining security, and we maintain tight control of the information that comes in and goes out, and we've restricted access to overseeing internet access to just a few people in Information Systems. So there are a few system administrators that we allow to have control of this, and that's all. Item F is what Dave was talking about early on. This is the part that talks about links to external websites, and the policy states that links can only be made to federal, state, and local government websites, and that is in concert with the opinion from Legislative Council. And those are the major points in the policy. There are three attachments. The first one is questions and answers. So it just has commonly asked questions about the website and about publishing. Attachment 2 has a sample of a legislator web page. It shows several things there that were information can be attached to the legislative or to the website. And the attachment 3 is the council opinion that talks about not only publishing but also just putting information on the legislative website. So that's kind of a quick overview of the policy. Be happy to answer questions or
any questions, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You noted that you had 1,000 links, web links, and that 8 of them clearly violated the rules because they linked to some form of political advocacy or perhaps to some sort of financial conflict. Were any of those links related to financial conflicts?
Chairman, Representative Merkley, I don't believe so. I believe they were all political in nature. I don't believe there were any that would have been in violation of the ethics statute.
I have a series of questions
sure.
for this. Thank
uh-huh.
you. I imagine a lot of the links were to nonprofit organizations, citizen groups within the community, Rotary clubs, things of this nature, and it's been your determination that although those weren't clear violations, you want all of those links removed?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the plurality, if not majority, of the links that appeared to be inappropriate were to actually to media sites, but there were a number of links to organizations such as the ones that you mentioned, yes. And in the interest of basically protecting my staff, I don't want them to be in a position of facilitating linking to organizations or any sites that could be in violation of the statute. So that's why we would prefer to not allow any of those links, yes.
And can you expand on how a link to a nonprofit site is a potential violation of a statute?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the link to the site itself, and if I get in trouble here, I'm going to ask Ted Ruttlinger to come up.
Why don't we ask Ted to come on forward?
And maybe that would be the best, just to allow Ted with his to respond to that.
Welcome. For the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Ted Reutlinger from Legislative Council. I'm the author of this short, succinct opinion on web links. As I understand your question, it was, why is a link to a nonprofit organization a violation of a law, or
yes.
would it be in every case?
Mm-hmm.
The legal answer is that it wouldn't necessarily be against the law in every case. However, with some nonprofit websites, there could be a problem under the ethics law if, for example, a relative of a member of the Legislative Assembly was somehow employed by that nonprofit. If the nonprofit had some sort of political advocacy contained on their website, advocating for or against a candidate, a measure, a petition, anything like that, the determinations about what is or is not against the law would have to be made on a case-by-case basis. A second difficulty with that is, as you know, content on the Internet and on web pages changes rapidly. And a link to a website that may be permissible at 1 o'clock may not be permissible at 15 after 1. And that makes it difficult if you are allowing links to non-governmental sites.
Okay. And I wanted to follow up on your comment, Mr. Henderson, about news organizations being violations of the law. Maybe you could expand on why you consider reference to, say, the Oregonian or the Statesman Journal to be a violation.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, and I would invite Ted to jump in here and help out if necessary, but the newspapers clearly advocate for and against measures that are before the voters. And we are not allowed to expend state resources in any measure that would advocate for or against either measures or candidates. And so our feeling was that rather than have links to these sites that do this, it was best not to have those links at all.
Can you comment also on what I understand is a concern about commercial advertising?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, a number of links contain links to commercial advertising. One good example is a number of members had links to the site that gives you directions to get someplace, or there are weather sites that people had links to, and many of those sites have links to commercial ventures.
Help me with my non-technical expertise here, but if for example I have a link to an article that's on a newspaper's site, does that article come up directly in most cases if you have the right URL in there, or does one have to wander through the home page, front page, so on and so forth in order to find it?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the ones that I've seen generally link to the article, but it is you are then at a point where you can go directly into the news organization's web page. It does not restrict you to just the content of that article. You've got that article, plus you've got direct links then into the rest of the media outlets page.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am perplexed by this whole situation, and I think that I'm not alone in that there are some things that you're saying which seem very clear to me and that I've always believed to be true, and that's namely that you can't use your public, any means of public communication, to advocate for a political cause or to do something to profit commercially. But I have a hard time getting from there to this complete prohibition on links to nonprofits and things that seem to not be causing problems before this. And I guess what's most perplexing to me is that as this whole thing has unfolded, I've looked a lot at websites from legislators in other states, and it seems like, although there's a whole range of what's on those websites, that I don't come across any that are really as restrictive as what is called for in this policy. And so I guess my question to you would be, what is it in Oregon law that makes it so stringent as compared to even our neighboring state of Washington, where they seem to just have a disclaimer on these websites and then go ahead and provide a lot of content that by this would be prohibited?
Co-chairs, Representative Rosenbaum, I can't speak to what other state laws say about this, but in Oregon it's clear that the statutes you described apply. You can't use your office for financial gain or to avoid a detriment, and that applies both to you, any relative you have, any business that you're associated with, and a business that a relative might be associated with. The second one is the political advocacy prohibition. The difficulty here is that there may be, well, and let me just state that the third one is generally the concept that public resources have to be spent for a public purpose. And in this case, money that is appropriated to the legislature and spent on the website needs to be spent for purposes that have something to do with the constitutional and statutory duties that the legislature is supposed to carry out. So with that said, it's possible that there may be permissible links to a nonprofit that doesn't violate the ban on use of office for gain or to avoid detriment, that has no political advocacy, and that in some way is connected to the purposes that the legislative assembly is supposed to carry out. It may be that there are some links like that that would be legally permissible under that framework. The difficulty is in figuring out whether or not they are permissible, who's going to decide whether or not they are permissible, and if they are permissible, then are they going to be permissible tomorrow? The risk of violations because of the changing technology seems high, and I think is one reason that led to this more restrictive policy recommendation.
So a follow-up. Thank you. I'm reading your opinion, and you do on the bottom of page 2 indicate that this would not be the only policy that would be allowable under the law, and then you suggest that linking to private websites that don't violate these prohibitions would be okay, and you go on to suggest that if we were to go down that route, that it should be the public official who bears responsibility if the policy is violated, which seems perfectly reasonable to me, not to put the staff in a bind. So why wouldn't it be okay to say, as long as it's not advocating a political cause or selling puppies or something else for profit, that it's okay and it's up to me to decide or to get in trouble if I end up putting something on there that violates those things? I mean, would that be an acceptable policy too?
Co-chairs, Representative Rosenbaum, from a legal perspective, it probably would be. The difficulty for the IS staff, for example, is with material that could possibly contain political advocacy. The election law statute not only prohibits members from directing public employees to engage in political activities, it prohibits public employees from actually doing so. And one thing I point out here, which is a potential risk of the risk to the IS staff, if in fact a member directs them to put material on the web, they could be accused of actually engaging in activity that promotes or opposes a candidate or a measure, etc. And then you would have an election law violation as the result. So in my opinion, I recommended a more restrictive approach to protect those people from potential exposure under the election laws. But you're right, as a legal matter, it's theoretically possible to come up with a less stringent policy, but then you have to decide who is going to make those decisions and who would bear responsibility.
Further questions, Representative Merkley?
I want to go back to the link to a news site. And, you know, I think we're at the start, not really at the start now, but a decade into a whole new world here, of which web use is a regular part of our life, and it presents new issues and things we have to wrestle with, and this is part of that. And so I appreciate the research and the commentary, and I'm sure that we'll be wrestling with this and rethinking this in the years to come. But there's no reason to wait for the years to come for all pieces, and that's why I've been asking questions and why Representative Rosenbaum has some thoughts here. But when I think about, if I put in a, I think it's called a URL, is that correct term, that takes someone to a specific article, and it's an article on something that is, let's say in my district, citizens are very concerned about storm sewers. They're very concerned about whether or not we can pass Jessica's Law, or they're concerned about payday loans, they're concerned about this or that, and there's an interesting article, then certainly there's some real public service in referring people to easy access to this information. Now, just because that link takes them to the article, I then kind of hear the note being sounded that, well, at that point, the person who's at that article has a choice of other links that they could take to go to other articles that might include political advocacy, the op-ed page, if you will, editorial column, letters to the editor, and that's a hazard. And as I hear that, I really hear kind of like we're going to censor the subsequent choices a citizen might make about what they look at on the web. I mean, they certainly can go to that site and look at those things. We've sent them to an article, and if they choose to go backwards, they're back to our main website. If they choose to abandon our website and explore other articles on that or other links on that, then isn't really that individual's, that citizen's decision about what they want to look for? And do we really want to go into their house, to their desk, to their laptop, and tell them what they were, that they, you know, aren't they making their own choice at that point when they go on and look at some other reference that we haven't sent them to?
Co-chairs Representative Merkley, my concern is with a link to an article in a newspaper which I have looked at, and there is advertising on the same page as the article. And to me, that's the risk. If a legislator or somebody else here in the building, some other public official, authorizes a link to an article that contains advertising for private business concerns on the same page, then you have a potential for an ethics law violation if there's some connection between the person who authorized that link and the advertising. Or, for example, if there's a connection between the person who authorized the link and the media organization, if that person's spouse, for example, works for the newspaper and somehow could obtain financial benefit as a result of a higher number of people viewing the page, then you've got a potential ethics law violation. That's the concern that I tried to talk about with respect to links to newspaper articles in particular.
So you're not at all concerned about the fact that within that newspaper site, then there's other things they could go to. You're just concerned about what shows up on the sides of the article that's being displayed?
Co-chairs, Representative Merkley, when I wrote the opinion, that was my concern, yes. Obviously, if you facilitate people being able to then further explore a commercial site or another site that has political advocacy, I think that's dangerous as well.
Is there any sort of an incidental or standard in the law? And I'll give you an example. Let's say I send out directions on how to get to my public forum on public safety. And people who follow those directions drive past a billboard advertising a campaign. Maybe my campaign, but maybe somebody else's campaign, or maybe an initiative campaign. And obviously, I didn't intend to promote that campaign by giving those directions. It's an incidental impact. And my impression of website advertising is changing daily. It's rotating through. None of us know what the heck's going to show on that page. And that's kind of an incidental exposure. Now, if I was to send people to a site where I have purchased advertising, let's say, for example, I send them to an article on a blog site where I have purchased advertising, I know the content, I know what's going to be there, I'm directly steering people into that political advocacy, that wouldn't be incidental. That would be quite different. But if we get in the incidental category, I mean, can we hardly move without violating the law in some way? Or
Co-chairs, Representative Merkley, I think you make a good point. If you start, and I don't know the answer to the question because this web link material is changing so rapidly that the ethics laws, of course, haven't been changed for quite some time. None of the statutes that I have looked at directly deal with web links. Secretary of State's election law manual does address web links, use of the internet, email. But the point is that if you had a site, if your spouse owned a furniture store, for example, and you linked to a newspaper article that showed up on the web next to an advertisement for that store, it seems pretty clear to me that applying the existing ethics laws, that would be a difficult situation.
One last question. There's a parallel to a 501c3 organization, a nonprofit organization that does charitable work or cultural work. And having lived in that world, I know that enormous number of our 501c3 websites have extensive links to provide links of use to the members of that organization or to people who care about that particular charitable work, be it a disease, be it building homes, be it educational, so on and so forth. And those links go to all sorts of websites that have advertising in the margins, if you will. Obviously, a 501c3 is not supposed to be promoting anyone's business interests, but I don't think there's been a prosecution anywhere in the country. You know, I say that as a non-lawyer who hasn't studied it, so on. But it's never kind of blossomed in the press that 501c3s are getting in trouble because they provide links on their sites, because it's just like so obvious that this is incidental exposure, not not advocacy, not an attempt to steer people. You know, is there any sort of a parallel there that helps us understand this issue?
Coach Ayers, Representative Merkley, I think the main difference, of course, is that the 501c3s are not spending public money. And money that's spent to facilitate the production and dissemination of material on the legislative website is using public money and is therefore subject to these laws. As far as your example goes, I don't know that there's a parallel because it seems to me that the 501c3's risk, of course, is losing their nonprofit status if they engage in political activity or start making too much money. In this case, again, what my opinion says is that the safest approach is to avoid the links that could get people into trouble. Whether or not the Ethics Commission, the Government Standards and Practices Commission, would consider a difference between a link that contains incidental advertising that's related to a member or a situation where somebody directly links to a site that everybody agrees is wrong, I don't know. But the risk is there. The risk, if you have those links, you have the risk of people filing complaints because, as you know, the Ethics Commission and the Secretary of State's office operates largely on a complaint-driven process. There doesn't seem to be any specific provision in the statutes that allows for an incidental exception.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think there's a lot of feelings and so on about this, but I'm under the understanding that all of these things, I share a lot of the concerns that Representative Rosenbaum and Merkley have brought up. But in the same token, I think all of these things have been gone through with staff and so on to cover in great detail about this. The whole idea of this thing is to protect the members, in my opinion. And I think that with the concerns that I share with my colleagues, we can go back and next session and do some things that may change this. But the ultimate thing is for the protection of the members, and that everyone get treated exactly the same. Through the interpretation, and that it gets that done. All of that being said, I don't like, so to speak, the big brother look that this causes, in my opinion, to occur. But in the same token, I don't want all the members or 10 of the members or whatever number that potentially were or could be in violation in the future to have a problem. So. I don't like the idea. But in the same token, I think this stuff has been hashed out several times up to this point.
Any further questions?
Senator Burdick? Kind of a technical question. What if you hook into a website, one of the clearly allowed website, and that at that particular website has a link to a private website, perhaps even a political website? It's unlikely that would happen, but it could. You could have another government website that did hook into a website that doesn't pass muster under this.
Co-Chair Senator Burdick, I think one reason why the policy recommends linking to government websites only is that the chances that you're going to have links off of those sites to private or political sites is remote, because I'm certain that most states would prohibit that. If, however, it were to happen, it seems to me that there's nothing that we can do to control that, and as long as the original link from the legislative page to a government site is permissible under our law, then I doubt seriously that anybody would find a violation as a result of the subsequent link, because the authorization made by a public official was to the first site, assuming that the content on that site was permissible. But you raise an interesting question, because the technology is changing and the statutes and the rules do not particularly or directly apply to this type of issue. So we are interpreting things as we go.
Follow up. Did you look at other states to find out what their policy, what their policies were before you drafted this?
In drafting the opinion, no, I didn't.
But, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, we have done some research through NCSL and independently of that. And what we did find, and I'd invite Rich to jump in here if he has specifics, was that we were the least restrictive site out there when we were allowing a number of links. Many states do not allow any links at all from their member pages, and those that do allow links, from what we've encountered, they've been links to other government sites.
And then, one more time, for example, a government site could be a congressional site, you know, from one of our congressmen. Is the federal policy that restrictive?
I'm sorry, Senator Burdick, I'm not aware of what the federal policy is.
Okay. Thank you.
I just had a question for counsel. One of the questions that was brought to my attention is, does the statute apply to the executive branch at all, or is this just merely restricted to the legislative branch?
Speaker Minnis, the statutes apply to all branches of government, so they will apply to the executive branch in the same way that they would apply to the legislative branch.
Okay. Any further questions? With that, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session. And I need to call Senator Brown. Is there?
We have a number right there. Is that the number we have? Senator Brown's number? She's calling the number. Where's the policy?
It's the first one in my handout.
Yeah, where's the actual policy wording?
The policy looks like that.
I'm going to have you. Yeah, would you?
Only move.
Paid on the phone.
And Madam Chair, I would suggest one very minor amendment to the policy before you do vote on it.
All right, which is?
On page 4 of 5 of the policy, item F, links to external websites. When we distributed the draft policy.
Okay, this is the speaker. We are in the process of getting ready to vote on this, the web links policy.
Okay.
And Mr. Henderson is in the process of explaining an amendment they'd like to add. So, Dave, could you go ahead and do that again?
When we distributed the draft policy throughout the building, Karen Quigley, the executive officer of the Commission on Indian Services, asked for one change, which we believe is a reasonable change. Page 4 of 5, item F, links to external sites. We would recommend including tribal government websites, so that the policy would read links from the legislative website, electronic mail system, and other legislative systems may only be made to federal, state, local, and tribal government websites.
Okay.
And then we would make the subsequent edits to the question and answer document as well to make it clear that links to tribal websites, as they are government websites, would be allowed. And that concludes it.
Did you want to testify?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Why don't you come on forward?
I don't have any sign-up sheet in it.
Why don't you come on forward? Before we take a moment.
Okay. Yeah. Did you want to reopen the public hearing?
We're fine.
Okay. Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Dawn Phillips. I'm here representing multiple members today. Representative Crummell, Representative Flores, Representative Thatcher, Representative Anderson, Representative Patty Smith, and while we were going through this policy, Representative Greg Smith was very concerned about some of the items that were being brought up.
Can you speak into that?
Yes, I can.
This is Don Phillips.
December 6th Representatives Thatcher, Anderson, and Wisnett asked the legislative web folks to post this news release. And it had links to ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, for a summit they were going to. And we received an email back from Daniel saying we cannot post this press release with those links because we have a policy we're trying to enforce. You know the old saying, don't ask the question because you don't want the answer? That's where we are today. Since December 6th, this has kind of evolved. Some of my other members had tried to link to the Boy Scouts or the Smart Reading Program. That was not acceptable. And I applaud the IT folks and Dave and his staff for working on a solution and trying to come up with a policy that was clear to everyone. But I'm not really sure after everything you've heard today that you're hearing a solution that is in search of a problem. I mean, up till now, this is a complaint-driven process. If somebody links to an ethics, commit an ethics violation or an election law violation, someone has to file a complaint. And I don't think we've had any complaints in the 5 or 6 years that this other policy was kind of out there or any of these election laws that members were linking to inappropriate sites. So I just want you to keep that in mind, that we really didn't have a problem with people complaining or violations going on, except for the handful that were posted that Dave mentioned that had already been out there. And let's be clear, we're not talking about the click here that takes you to the Boy Scouts. We're talking about also listing the actual URL. You cannot list www.boyscouts from now on under this policy. And most of the members of the public and most of the members of the assembly that I've talked to since we kind of brought this up have said they think the whole thing is pretty ridiculous, that we're all responsible for what we post there, and for the most part it's been in the interest of public information. I also had a question about whether this new web policy includes audio or video. That's not mentioned anywhere, so that's something I think we need to address down the road. I think there's a big picture here. In terms of why do we have legislative websites at all? And it's to provide information to our constituents and help them get information, and not just about government sites. We talk a little bit about trying to help folks not always be dependent upon government for what they need. And maybe there's something in the community that could help them. Maybe there's a mobile home site that they could go to learn about, you know, some of the things going on in the mobile home industry right now. Maybe they could go to the Smart Reading Program website and help their kid learn how to read. So I think it's important that we look at the big picture here, which is how do we best help our constituents? And I think Representative Burdick brought up a good point about how when you go to some of these government websites, including our very own governor, there are tons of links in there to nonprofits and private organizations. Tons. Go look for yourself sometime. If you look at the last paragraph of the policy, it talks about how computer technology is changing rapidly, and Representative Merkley mentioned that as well. But it seems a little hypocritical to me that we're making the Capitol wireless, we're talking about going to a paperless floor session, but yet we're kind of going backwards when it comes to giving our constituents good information on their websites and whatnot. And in the long run, what you're going to see is a lot of members using private websites and private email to distribute links to community websites, because private websites and private email are not under this policy. And some of the members are already using that, and I think you're going to see more and more of that. And the question was asked earlier by legislative council, who's going to decide? Well, you're still faced with that question, and those folks are in the room today. Staff is now going to decide what members can and can't put on their websites, and what is a government site and what isn't. In fact, your legislative administration is already using a site, it's called SurveyMonkey, to put out a legislative survey. It's not a government website. So how strict are we going to be with the rules? NCSL is apparently an acceptable site now under these rules. It's not a government website. It's a membership-driven association for legislators, just like ALEC. So who's going to be deciding when it is or it isn't acceptable? And I think one thing we haven't talked about today, which is the 800-pound gorilla in the room, is this applies to your email. It's very clearly stated in the policy here that legislative systems include email. So who's going to police the email? If a legislator comes, if a constituent comes to me or a legislator and says, hey, can you send me a link to that AARP prescription drug site? I saw some good information on there the other day. I can't send it to him in email now under this policy. If someone forwards me an email that's got a link to maybe a great mobile home website that has got free help for all the mobile home people who got kicked out of their park, I cannot send that link on to a constituent to help them. So I want to know whose staff is going to be going in and checking our email and making sure it's correct before it goes out. That's something I think you need to seriously consider. And in the Legislative Council's opinion, it does not limit email transactions or government websites. It only says you can't violate the ethics or the elections law. So I think the policy is going a little beyond what Legislative Council had asked for. And finally, let's talk a little bit about enforcement. It says on page 5, or on policy number 5, subsection D, as we discussed earlier, these are legislators are considered to be administrative heads. And it says, all content published on the legislative website must be approved by the appropriate legislator or agency head. So does that mean if I want to send a link to a constituent in an email, I'm going to have to call up my legislator and tell him what I'm doing and ask him for permission because he is considered the agency head of my office? So let's think about how we're going to do this chain of command and who's enforcing. I have a couple of legislators who are out of town quite a bit right now, and it's hard to get a hold of them, but I know they want me to post something on their website when it's finished. I have to then get written permission from them and somehow get it to Dave before it can be posted. If it's time sensitive about a meeting that's coming up, that's going to be difficult to do. So I think we need some kind of a process for how that's going to be handled in terms of legislators giving some kind of written permission to the legislative folks to be able to post that. And what's the punishment? What are we talking about here if you put out a web link or a click here that goes to a nonprofit? It's basically, as I understand it, again, a complaint-driven process where someone would have to file suit against you in court saying you're violating ethics or elections laws. But if we're going to be policing our staff, and I'm speaking from a staff perspective here, what's the punishment for staff for posting an illegal link or giving someone a www.boyscouts.com? Representative Scott raised a really good question about protecting the members. Do they really need protection? I mean, they're elected officials. The buck stops there. They're responsible for what happens in their office and the information that they disseminate. As far as I know, there haven't been any complaints. There haven't been any lawsuits. So I'm wondering how much protection they really need. And finally, I guess we've mentioned a little bit about working on a bill for next session, and we've already started drafting one that would do just that, put the responsibility in the hands of the legislator and would absolve staff of any kind of liability should they something happen to pass through their hands. I would really like to see us embrace this technology. I mean, how many of you members use a cell phone or a PDA or a laptop or any of those gadgets? I bet a lot of your constituents do, too. And I bet they'd like to go to your website and be able to go to helpful links to learn more about what you're doing and maybe get some help from you and your staff. And I just see us going backwards with this policy, and I'd like to see us move forward. So thank you for listening to our comments today.
Thank you. Don, any questions? Representative Merkley?
Thank you very much for your testimony, Don, and it certainly echoes some of my concerns. But I did, you did make a point here that I wanted to clarify. You said under these rules, a link to NCSL is acceptable.
I believe it's on the Q&A page that was distributed.
On the Q&A page.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Under number 4?
So to her observation, why would NCSL be acceptable and ALEC not?
Madam Chair, as NCSL and Council of State Governments are specified in item number 4 of the Q&A document, and we discussed including ALEC in that as well, and I apologize. I'm not aware of why ALEC was not included. But as Council of State Governments and NCSL are both membership organizations of which the legislature is a member, we felt that it was appropriate to link to those sites. And we would be happy to add ALEC if, assuming it passes the muster of legislative council. My understanding is that expenditures to ALEC conferences are allowed as official expenditures, so we could certainly include them.
Well, I do appreciate your addressing that, because as far as I'm aware, ALEC is open to all legislators, I believe. And there are a number of other associations of legislators as well that have different emphasis in terms of policy. And so there's a national legislators progressive forum or something like that. I'm not sure just what the name is, but anyway, I did want to clarify if NCSL was a single exception and what the kind of the standard was for accepting it and not accepting other organizations.
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, the standard that we used was what has been allowed under House and Senate rules as far as expenditure of legislator funds. And it has been allowed to expend funds for NCSL activities, CSG activities, and ALEC activities. And so those three organizations specifically we intended to include. And again, I apologize that ALEC was not listed separately.
If I can. So let's say I go to an NCSL website or an ALEC website, and on that website are opinion pieces about initiatives, so on and so forth. Does that put it in conflict with the rest of the kind of the theory that's in you're embracing in this set of standards?
Co-Chair's Representative Merkley, yes, it does, because the election laws are pretty clear that you cannot use state employees, public employees, time on work hours to promote or oppose positions on candidates, measures, initiative petitions, etc. I do not know if a site like NCSL contains that kind of political advocacy. My assumption was that it did not, because it is a membership organization that all state legislatures can belong to, and that it is organized along a nonpartisan basis. But that's my assumption.
My guess is that it contains all kinds of positions. There is different forums on insurance, on minimum wage, on labor standards, on environmental standards, and everything. I mean, it is a forum for discussion. I'm guessing the website also has elements of that forum aspect to it, but can't say I visited it recently.
Madam Chair, if I may, the legislative expense accounts also pay for chamber memberships in the past, so I'm not sure if that's the standard or not. Why aren't we linking to chambers then? We also are allowed to pay for newspaper subscriptions using our legislative accounts. So why aren't we linking to our newspapers?
Okay. Thank you, Don. Yes, Senator Burdick.
When you bring up the email, this is really a can of worms. Because what if you had a constituent writing about a concern about an issue and you just happened to have a document, say, from both sides of the issue, and sent the documents to the constituent as an attachment to let them know what other groups were saying. Am I to hear that that's not permissible?
Co-Chair Senator Burdick, I think the answer to that depends upon what the documents say. If the documents are, contain advocacy for or against a candidate, a measure, or an initiative petition, vote yes on petition 53, or please sign petition 53, vote yes on measure 43, that sort of material, then that is going to be prohibited by the existing election laws. If you are simply disseminating information about an issue that doesn't contain advocacy, then that's not prohibited.
I see our chief clerk of the House has walked in the room. Would you like to comment on this? We're in a public hearing or a work session. And Representative Flores, did you want to speak on this as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ramona Kennedy, chief clerk of the House. I was watching, obviously, on the in-house television, and I just wanted to clarify a couple of comments that was made. I can't speak for the Senate, but on the House side, we do not pay out of legislative funds memberships to the Chamber of Commerce's. We only allow for memberships where it is strictly, or money is to be used where it's strictly a legislative organization. And right now, we've limited that to the NCSL and CSGR obviously paid through budget items. We do allow for membership in ALEC and any of those expenses to attend any of their professional development seminars. And we also have paid for the Hispanic Legislative Caucus and the Black Caucus. Those are the only four organizations right now that if you have service and supplies monies and you want to be part of a membership. Now, if you're going to go to a conference that is strictly for legislators on both sides of the aisle and, you know, it's open to everyone and it's in a subject matter that is of interest to you, obviously those expenses are paid, but we don't pay for the memberships. And I think that there's a real difference between what can you be a member of and, you know, how we see professional development opportunities. I just wanted to make that one quick clarification. I don't know if this has been said, but I know that staff over the course of the last 10 years have struggled with trying to provide some parameters. And so obviously this is a decision that is really up to the committee, but something that we have thought long and hard about in order to provide the best website information possible within all the parameters that are either through guidance of legislative council and also looking at other states. And I would suggest that if you were to check with NCSL, and we have, Oregon allows a lot more information on their websites. In fact, we would suggest over the line. And what we're doing by this recommendation is pulling us back, keeping us on cutting edge of what is being provided, but yet making it very responsible in allowing for the information that is going out to the constituency to be standardized, for it to be fair, and for the policy to be set by the legislature. With that, I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Ramon.
Thank you.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Linda Flores, State Representative. My comments will be very brief. I am somewhat concerned about the extent and the direction of the discussion and the concern about the utilization of technology for the benefit of our constituents. I can understand the needs to be protective of, for instance, linking to campaign websites and campaign activities. However, providing information in a broad context in order to help our constituents' needs, I think, is something that needs to be the overriding concern. Oregon's always been on the cutting edge, and so I'm not sure that pulling us back from areas where we have already tread is necessarily a overriding concern for members of us. So I would just encourage very careful deliberation as you move forward on this particular policy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a motion. Any other comments before we go any further?
Madam Chair.
Comments.
I know you're Madam Somebody. I'm very troubled by being confronted with only this policy as a choice. It just seems to me that something that started as a fairly innocent exploration has ended up being carried to a real extreme, and it really isn't the only alternative that we could have looked at. And I would much rather than having to vote yes or no on this today, see if we couldn't come up with a policy that was somewhat more moderate than this, because just sitting here listening to the discussion, I can think of all sorts of things which probably could run afoul of this, which aren't at all. I mean, the voter's pamphlet, for one, which clearly, if you're linking to the Secretary of State's website, you're also linking to the voter's pamphlet, probably is also not permissible according to the very most draconian interpretation of this rule. So, and you know, it seems to me that if we end up with a policy that's so strict that we have websites that are nothing but a list of contact information and maybe a biography, then we might as well not have them at all, because we're really not being allowed to provide something that's tailored to or useful to our particular districts. And I just, it seems very punitive to me, as well as kind of paternalistic, to say that legislators are incapable. I mean, much as I appreciate that you're looking out for us and trying to keep us from getting in trouble, that's a lot of what we do, is make sure that we're doing our job without violating the law. And I think that we ought to be trusted, once the law has been clarified for us, to exercise some judgment about that.
Mr. Ratlinger, can they link to the voter's pamphlet?
Madam Chair, I think so, because it's a government site paid for with public funds. It's on the Secretary of State's site. The legislature has passed a variety of laws that set up procedures for dissemination of the voters' pamphlets, for political statements to be in the voters' pamphlet. It's, in effect, state-sponsored speech, because the state pays for it. So I don't think it would violate this policy.
But if advocacy is the criterion here, you could actually, and I'm not technically proficient, but you could actually put out a thread long enough to link to a specific argument in favor of a measure on the Secretary of State, or an argument in favor of yourself, your own candidacy. Which would be straight advocacy.
Senator Burdick, you're right, it would be, but it would be a link to a government site that's paid for with public money.
Representative Murphy.
I beg to differ, because the people who submit articles for the voters' pamphlet pay for those sites, and so private money is very much involved. But I don't want to argue that point, because maybe I'm wrong and you can correct me, but the gist here is that, to me, it makes sense for us to lay out a range of options for us to be able to weigh essentially what is a service to our constituents, makes the website truly fulfill that role of helping citizens function better within our democracy. Now, what we have here is the option that's the end of the spectrum of safety as the ultimate gain. And a parallel is when a community rips out its playground because they're afraid of a lawsuit, and lose sight of the fact that serving children is also part of the goal. And so it makes sense for us to have several different policy options that weigh these issues of conflict of interest, in which you are referring people to a site which feathers your own nest or that of a relative, or to a site which advocates for a position, and weigh that and see what kind of parameters can be developed that minimize that while maximizing our value to citizens. And since I think it's been pointed out, and no one has corrected it, that there hasn't been a complaint to date, that we're on relatively safe ground. We've been pointed out that of 1,000 links, 8 were found to be a clear violation, and that those were accidental mistakes in the area where people had uploaded a newsletter or done something that created that link. Well, what about those other 1,000 links that were very useful to citizens? And so I would like to ask that our committee request that we go back to the drawing board and bring forth options for the committee to weigh, that we are able to circulate those options in a conversation with our legislators, with our caucus members, to get their input on how they feel about it, and then bring that conversation back to bear at a future meeting to try to see what the best course forward might be.
Mr. Rettlinger, what happens if we do nothing with this and we don't move this forward today? What becomes our liability, if any, if we don't move on this?
Madam Speaker, the election laws and the ethics laws will continue to apply to content and links from the legislative website. I suspect that the policy that LAC currently has in position with respect to the website would be the policy that continues to apply. I'm certain that that policy has material in it that says things like the legislative website shall be used only for public purposes and may not contain links to private sites that would violate the ethics laws or the election laws. Dave, you may want to...
Madam Chair, we would have to make a decision at that point as to what we would do, because we do not at this point have a formally adopted policy from the committee. And if I might for just a moment address the concerns raised by Representatives Merkley and Rosenbaum, I want to be clear that we did not set out in this exercise to be draconian and make this difficult for legislators. In fact, we have looked at a number of options that I believe you're speaking of that would be middle ground options of how could we implement something that allows valuable community links that would not be allowed under this policy. And the discussion in the group that considered those quickly devolved into arguing about, well, if you're going to allow this, are you going to allow that? Are you going to allow this? And are you going to allow that? So it's not for lack of effort on our part to find a way to allow links of interest to legislators and of interest to their constituents. But we were left at a point of, if we can't come with something that the group can agree on as a reasonable approach, we were left with, we had to draw the line somewhere. This was a place that we felt we could draw the line that would be enforceable.
Senator Courtney.
I want to answer generic questions. My understanding, counsel, that at this time the elections laws and ethics laws of the state of Oregon do apply to the websites that Oregon, the legislators have. Is that correct?
Senator Courtney, yes, that's correct.
And at this time, there is no policy in place by the legislature and or their rules that comply with those laws that exist.
Senator Courtney, I don't understand your question.
In effect, with exception, the laws stand, and in your opinions, both legislative counsel and the attorney generals, at this time, we do not have a policy in place that would guide us as to implement and comply with the election laws and the ethics laws of this state involving how we use our websites.
Senator Courtney, I believe the answer to your question is yes, and that's what this policy would do.
In effect, this is an administrative rule. You pass laws, and you have administrative roles to implement the laws. Is that not that is the way we operate, basically, in our form of government?
Senator Courtney, yes, that's true.
All right. And while this policy, if adopted today, like any policy, may not be final, dynamic, evolving documents, you could introduce legislation next session that goes into this issue. You can come back to this policy as issues arise in terms of legislative administration committee to review that policy on an ongoing basis. Is that correct?
Senator Courtney, yes. That's correct.
Madam Speaker, I'm prepared to make a motion to approve this policy as it is before us today, recognizing fully well that we've already been told a piece of legislation will be reduced next session, as well as to make sure that we understand this committee can convene, as it does, to potentially review any policy that exists, to review amendments and or additional discussions by legislative counsel, the attorney general, or members. I do think that we have been warned. We are being warned by our legislative counsel and the attorney general. We do not have a policy in effect, and we've got election law and ethics laws we've got to deal with here. Now, that's I think there's some incredible questions have been asked, and if you watch the witnesses, they weren't sure sometimes, because that is the nature of these things. It's a question of fact. Many times it's a question of fact. So I'm comfortable today moving forward. I don't know if the votes are here. I'm comfortable understanding that whatever the votes are, that we will come back to this policy on a regular basis, either as a committee or and or through legislation that will be introduced, which is the appropriate way to do things.
So, Senator Courtney, would you like to make a motion?
I move, Co-Chair, that the Legislative Administration Committee adopt the policy, legislative website publishing policy, as listed in the Legislative Administration document dated June 19, 2002, Oregon Legislative Information System Subject Publishing on legislative website.
Any discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair, thank you. I will be opposing the adoption of this policy. And I think it's been pointed out that the legal opinion says that there are different legal courses that can be pursued. The working group that Mr. Henderson referred to, I have not been part of. As to my knowledge, none of my caucus has been. My staff has raised its concerns previously in the briefings that I believe your office has given to them. And we do have a range of legitimate choices. We also have in existence a law on which anyone can make a complaint at any time. So there is a process in place without adopting these policies, which choose to favor complete protection at the expense of serving citizens well. Since we haven't had a complaint, I think we should continue to operate within the law. If there's a problem, we'll have a complaint. We certainly are all on warning now of the types of things that, of the eight examples that have been given or discovered of mistakes that were made. We're certainly in a position to educate our members about those mistakes while leaving in place the ability to serve our constituents in the best possible way. So I'd like to see us come back with multiple options, and I'll oppose the motion.
Would you like to take the vote? Yeah. Representative Rosenbaum? I think we're going to need a roll call vote. That's what we're going to need.
Well,
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just at a loss because I don't think that we're putting the state at risk by not adopting this policy today. If I thought so, I would certainly be prepared to swallow hard and vote for it. But the fact is, the laws that apply to us will still apply to us. I mean, it's not like we have a policy to restate every law in the state of Oregon and say that we have to follow it. So I just don't think that any evil will befall us. And I am, frankly, share the comments that Representative Merkley has made, that if the options were presented to some other committee of, I guess, staff people, those options should be in front of this committee, because this is where those policies ought to be chewed on and set. And so I think that I will also be voting no today.
Representative Scott?
Can you share with us who was on the policy committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it was presented to the Information Technology Governance Board, which consists of myself, Legislative Counsel, Legislative Fiscal Officer, Legislative Revenue Officer, Secretary of the Senate, Chief Clerk of the House, the Chiefs of Staff to the six leadership offices. So it's all the staff directors, the heads of all of the staff organizations in the building.
Thank you.
Want to take a roll call? Senator Brown, are you there? We didn't know it was going to go on that long. I wouldn't have called you so soon.
Right. No problem.
Thank you.
Annetta, you want to do a roll call?
Senator Beyer. Senator Brown.
Kate, it's time to vote.
Aye.
Senator Perry is excused. Representative Merkley? No. Representative Pickens is excused. Representative Rosenbaum? No. Representative Scott? No. President Courtney? Yes. Senator Burdick? Yes. Madam Chair?
Aye. Motion fails. We'll revisit this at a later time. Go on to the next item.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that we go to a brief report on the status of the bill drafting project at this point. Right. As you're aware, the money was appropriated in the 05 session to develop the system to replace the bill drafting system that Legislative Council uses to prepare measures and amendments. And we made a presentation to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology and the Emergency Board at its previous meeting. We were requested to report to the Emergency Board that met today on that. We presented information in the form of a letter to the Emergency Board, which was approved today on your consent calendar. And I'll just ask Rich Anglis to do a very brief overview of that, the status of that project.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rich Anglis. I'm the Information Systems Manager for the Legislature, and I'd like to give you a broad brush status update on where we are today with bill drafting. We reported to you back in it was March 21st meeting on kind of where we were at that time, and we had gone through a requirements definition process, and we were involved in an RFP process at that time to select a vendor to help us implement the bill drafting project and to buy software. Since that time, we have been through a selection process. We completed the RFP selection process, and there was a unanimous choice for a company called Propylon, which is a developer of legislative systems. And we began negotiations with Propylon to see if we could get costs down to a minimum level. In their proposal, the costs were scheduled to be about $4.5 to $6.5 million. We negotiated that down to $3.16 million and brought a total project cost using that figure plus additional project costs, total project cost figure of $4.3 million to the e-board in early April. And at that meeting in April, the e-board asked us to do some additional work on this to see if we could reduce the costs even further, but eBoard did approve moving forward with the project, and an expenditure limitation increase to about $2.8 million this biennium to proceed with the project. So we did proceed with additional negotiations with Propylon and were able to reduce their cost by about $165,000, down from 3.16 to 2.995. And in addition, in that same process, they put back in one of the components of the software, the publishing piece, which had been taken out earlier. And it was put back in because Legislative Council and Propylon both thought it was essential to have it. It's such an integrated part of the system. So that piece came back in. So even though we reduced the cost by $165,000, the total value that we ended up with out of that process was more like $600,000. At the same time, we also negotiated with the other vendors that are helping us on this project. We have a vendor helping us with project management and also hired a QA firm, a quality assurance firm, and we renegotiated the contracts with those firms and freed another $170,000 on the project for a total savings of about $335,000 off the original cost. So the way it stands now, the total project costs are set at $3.994 million, and of that, $2.995 million is the cost for the Propylon system. In late May, we discussed this project with the President and the Speaker, and they approved us moving forward on the basis of those reductions and asked us also to brief the other leadership offices, and we did that with as many folks as we could find. It was difficult to find everyone at that time, but we did as much as we could. After we completed that process, we started talking about the contract with Propylon and have been involved in that process since. Legislative Council did a draft for us of a contract, and we were asked by eBoard to go to the Attorney General's office also for a review. And so we talked with the Attorney General's office. They helped us a bit, but because of their work schedule, they contracted with an outside firm called Black Headerline to actually help us finish the contract out and get it in place. And we are continuing to work with attorneys from Black Headerline to complete the contract. We're well into the process. We expect to have the final version of the contract done on June 30th, next Friday. And at that time, we'll do some additional reviews inside the organization to make sure that it has everything that we need. We expect it to be in the hands of Propylon by about July 7th. And We're hopeful that it won't take a great deal of negotiation at that time, so we're hopeful that by mid to late July we'll be able to get the contract signed and move forward. And one thing I wanted to emphasize is this: we were asked to make sure that this contract was a fixed price contract, and that wording is going to be put in this so that there, it will be a fixed price for Propelon's participation in the project. And just wanted to talk just about funding just for a second. We have, as you all know, I'm sure this is being funded by COP bonds. And with the expenditure limitation, we have the authority this biennium to move forward with the project at the level of about $2.8 million in COP funds. We have gone through two COP sales to date. There's one more scheduled for next March to complete the funding required for this biennium. Then in next biennium, we'll need one more COP sale to finish the funding required, and that will be for about $1.1 million. So in order to do that sale, we are submitting a policy option package that approves us to go ahead with that COP sale. And I just wanted to also mention that there are recurring costs for this IT system, just like any other. And in that policy option package, we will put the recurring costs as well. So those are for maintenance and support of the system over time. Our expectation at this point is we will continue with the maintenance, which allows us to have updates from the vendor on an ongoing basis. But over time, the support will be taken over by the information system staff here. And we expect that to happen within a period of 4 years or less. So we're moving forward. We're on our schedule. Our schedule indicates that we will start finishing up requirements probably in August. About November of this year, we'll have the software from Propelon installed. In January, start customization so that it fits Legislative Council's needs. And we expect by about July to have what's called a beta version of that software in place. So they will deliver the first cut, if you will, of the software. And the goal will be over the next 7 months to make sure that that's a version that will work for us and get it in final shape. So the final system will be implemented in February of 2008. And that meets Legislative Council's time frame of having a system ready to use for the 2009 session. So as they start doing their drafts in the spring of 2008, they would be using this system. So that's our timetable. And I should say that we are all very happy with what we've ended up here. This Propelon system is the one that meets most of the needs of Legislative Council. It's a very robust system. It will require some customization, but it really does meet most of Council's needs right out of the chute, and they're very happy to actually see what they're going to get, and they're very pleased with that. And as you all know, this is a very important system. It's the one that they use for drafting, publishing, and shepherding bills as they go through the legislative process. So the project seems to be going along very well right now.
Mr. Anderson, did you want to say anything?
That completes our report on the bill drafting project, unless if you have any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay. The final agenda item, Madam Chair, is an update on the wing renovation project. As you know, the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature's Facilities Committee spent quite some time reviewing the needs of the building and correcting some of the problems that we have in the building. You have in your packet a letter from the architect who has developed the plans for the wing renovation project. As a bit of history, in the late 90s, we knew we had issues relating to wiring and plumbing and computer cabling in the building, and we put together a proposal to address these issues, and the 2001 legislature approved funding for the renovation of the wings. The authority for issuance of COPs was included in the bonding bill in the 2001 session. In 2002, we actually proceeded with issuing COPs to do the renovation of hearing rooms A through F and the hallway outside here. So that work was done in preparation for moving into the wings themselves. The intention was, and infrastructure was put in place at that time, to move staff out of the wings into these hearing rooms for an interim period and then proceed with the renovation in the wings themselves. Unfortunately, as you know, in 2002, when the economy went into recession, revenue projections slowed, and prior to the 2003 session, the final emergency board did not approve proceeding with renovation of the wings because of the fiscal situation that the state faced. Following the 2005 session with the creation of the public commission, this issue was referred to the facilities committee of the commission, which, as I said, studied the issue. We have for you here some visual aids of what you face in the wings, and I think the most telling one, perhaps, is this, and this is water drawn from the president's sink in the office of the Senate president, just to give you an idea of what we're facing now. These pieces of pipe you're welcome to come and look at, and you'll see that there is visual corrosion inside of them, and that's what's in the coming out of the drinking fountains and all the sinks in the wings. As important or even more important than that, a number of issues that we face in the wings. There is cabling for the computer system that was not installed to code. The danger of that is that it is wrapped in plastic that, should there be a fire, the plastic would release toxic fumes. It was supposed to be in trays, and it would have been to code and been allowable at that point, but there are numerous places in the wings where the cabling was not installed in trays, so it is clearly a health hazard. We have inadequate electrical distribution in the wings, leading people to string extension cords and things of that nature to be able to provide power to personal computers and fax machines and all of the modern office equipment that was not anticipated when the wings were constructed. The sprinkler system in the wings is not adequate should there be a fire. There are a number of places where there have been penetrations through the floors, which would create a chimney effect, so should there be a fire, it would spread rapidly from floor to floor. All of these are outlined in the letter from the architect. All of these issues were considered by the Facilities Committee, which unanimously recommended to the full public commission that we proceed with the wing renovation following the 2007 session. That proposal went to the full commission when they met about a month ago, and the commission unanimously approved that recommendation. We are at a point now where we need to begin to prepare. If we are to proceed with the renovation following the 07 session, we need to invest money to bring the plans that were put together in 2001 and 2002 up to code and prepare to go out to bid sometime early in 2007 to solicit bids on proceeding. No decision, obviously, on the project itself can proceed without action by the 2007 Legislative Assembly in the form of approving either an appropriation or issuance of COPs. We feel that it would be prudent to move forward now, and it is our intention to do so with expending the money on the engineering and architectural work to have those plans ready should we be in a position to move forward with the renovation project following the 07 session. Herb Kolom is here from Facility Services, and he has with him the plans that were assembled by the architect. I would invite you to come and review those plans and ask any questions you might have. Herb is also available to take you on a tour. We took the commission members on a tour of the wings and showed them the things that we've been talking about here, and we'd be happy to take any of the members of the committee at the conclusion of the meeting today on a similar tour and show you that. So this was an informational item for your purposes, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions?
So, Madam Speaker?
Yes.
The letter is over 4 years old.
That's correct.
And it was based on information collected in the late 1990s?
That is correct.
Even though you're not an architect, you've already identified, have you identified all the other things that have happened since then? Something about this penetration in ceilings or floors, I don't understand what you meant by that, Dave. What is that about?
Chairman, as co-chair Courtney, there are places when the wings were constructed, and you may recall this, many of these have been removed now, but there were electrical boxes that sat on top of the floor where you would plug in your electric typewriter at the time or whatever the device was.
Yeah.
As we have remodeled and done work, we have removed many of those electrical boxes, but there was conduit in the floor below that to allow wiring to get to those. Some of those areas have just been capped off, and those floor penetrations have never been filled. So there are a number of places that we can't even tell you exactly where they are because they're covered with carpet, where there are holes drilled between one floor and the next floor that existed for electrical wiring that now are just holes that have not been filled. There are some other issues that we have identified as we've worked with the architect now to prepare to move forward with this. The elevators in the wings are due for upgrades, which are required by the elevator code, and that is something that it would make sense now to do as long as we're going in and working on the wings. That's going to be an additional expense.
I guess we're okay. The following 93, in the quake kit, I guess everything's been handled in the wings, no problems there.
Chair Minutes, Co-Chair Courtney, the wings were built late enough that they comply with earthquake code.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Merkley?
Just to give us a visual sense of this, it sounds like it's gutting out the whole building, pulling off the carpet, going back to the core and rebuilding it?
Chairman, it's Representative Merkley. That would be the case in the second, third, and fourth floors on the House wing and the second and third floors on the Senate wing. Basically, the floors where members' offices are. We would go in, we would gut those floors completely. Walls would come out, carpeting, everything, plumbing, electrical, everything would come out. We would come back in, replace those systems, and then create offices again for the members. One nice side effect of all this is that then all of the members' offices would be identical. And as you know, there have been times in the past where some members had larger reception areas and things of that nature. Under the plans that we've produced, all the members' offices would be identical in size and appearance. On the first floor of the House wing and on the first and fourth floors of the Senate wing, most of the existing walls and private offices would remain because there's not a need to go in there and make those changes. So we would not do as extensive a work in those areas, but it would still include replacing ceilings, carpeting, plumbing, and things of that nature.
I think I understood you to say that what we're doing now is you're getting the plans ready, and the next legislature would have to decide if they can tackle the cost.
That's correct.
And where would our legislative staffs operate from during the time that the wings are being gutted?
That is something that we are working on right now. We're trying to determine how many people we could locate into these hearing rooms, and if there's not adequate space in these rooms and in other portions of the old building, we would be looking at space outside of the Capitol. We've already had some discussions with Willamette University as to whether they would have some facilities that might be available, and we've been in discussions with Department of Administrative Services as well.
Thank you.
Further questions?
It appears why the third floor of the Senate was not included in your statement. Fourth floor.
Fourth floor is, for the most part, IS, Information Systems offices. And it would be included in the replacement of ceiling, floors, plumbing, and things of that nature. But we would not gut that space and take out all the offices because there's not a need to in that area.
Nothing in the older buildings are involved Capitol, but it would be affected by any of this?
Madam Chair, Co-Chair Courtney, at this point, no, but we will be presenting, and I'll just give you a heads up right now, an option package for your consideration in 2007 to begin the same architectural and engineering work that needs to be done to prepare plans for the old portion of the building that was done for the wings in the past. So in this project, we would not affect the old portion of the building, but there's significant work that is needed there as well. And we will be coming back in 2009, 2011 at some point with recommendations on that.
Right, because there are two restroom facilities I'm aware of that are constant tapes and are unusable in terms of certain facilities in there. It's been going on, it sounds like, for 100 years, and I've just sort of noticed it. And I don't know what that all means, but it's very obvious that some plumbing issues exist in the old building.
It's a 70-year-old building that needs some care and attention.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Any further questions? Senator Burdick?
Is the reason for gutting all the offices in the Senate part, I can't remember what you said about the House part, is the sole reason just to get them all the same size, or is there a structural reason for that?
Chair, Minister, Senator Burdick, they're doing the work. It will be more efficient to do the work by gutting the space and taking the walls out completely. One of the other issues that we run into now are that the walls that exist are not floor-to-ceiling walls. They only go partway up, which is why you can frequently hear your neighbors' conversations as clearly as conversations in your own office. So we would address some of those issues. It would also give us the opportunity to ensure that we had adequate electrical supply to both the members' private offices and the staff spaces out in front of those offices.
Any other questions? Any closing remarks?
No, ma'am.
Thank you very much. With that, we're adjourned.